Hello. An hour. This is number 10 already. We're getting good at this here. And our theme tune is on. And if you noticed the style of the theme tune, it's very South American, full of rhythms and dancing, and it's all... The maracas are coming in very soon. And the reason we have this on is... actually due to our very special guest today. So, we've gathered together in Shepherd's Bush, London, our provisory studio as always. And with me in my provisory studio as always is the Costa Rican composer, Federico Ruben. I just presented you a bit like a soccer star there, hey Federico.
Hello, Ophir.
Nice to have you with us.
It's nice to be here.
That's a pleasure for us always. You have a friend in Khalas Radio.
That is amazing.
And Federico Ruben, to just give you some kind of indication, got a bit of an explosion there. Federico Ruben was born in Costa Rica, 1978, so we're actually born in the same year. Are you older than I?
I think you're older than me.
Which month?
I'm December.
Does that also mean that I'm stronger? That we can. But anyway, Federico Ruben, born Costa Rica, 1978, was trained as a pianist since the age of 9, studied political science for 2 years at Universidad de Costa Rica. This is in San Jose?
Correct.
Right. Very, very exciting city from what I hear.
Absolutely.
Really? Yes. Wasn't it the first city to have electricity? Or was that the second city after Paris or something like that?
Exactly. The second city. Wow, your knowledge about Costa Rica is impressive.
Thank you. I read Wikipedia daily. that's probably the most exciting thing that happened to San Jose since then.
Well, we made it to the World Cup in 1990 for the first time. I think that was probably as exciting for the Costa Rican people, at least.
Right. Huh. Yeah, it's quite exciting. Israel's never done that yet, and it's probably never going to do that, but hey. Let me go on here. So you've studied 2 years of political science at the Universidad de Costa Rica before leaving for the United States in 1999 to study composition with Lawrence Moss at the University of Maryland. Exactly. In September 2002, you moved to the Netherlands to continue your studies at the Royal Conservatoire in The Hague. And you earned a bachelor's in 2003 and a master's in 2006. This was in composition, of course, as well, but you studied there with Louis Andriessen. Who else? Richard Ayres, Gidius van Berghuyck, Martijn Padding. And currently you're actually studying as well.
Diederik Wagenaar. As well.
Okay. Good to mention. Currently pursuing your PhD here in London at Brunel University.
Correct.
And this is under whom exactly?
Richard Barrett and Christopher Fox. Yeah. Well, I'm almost finished.
So this is these are your final stages.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, good luck with that. Well, I think we'll talk about your research just in a bit. But before we do that, I'd just like to tell you that today's program is actually an interesting one for me, because unlike my other programs in which I talk about the musical oeuvre of a specific composer, or at least try to play a few pieces to give a glimpse into the life of that composer, what we're going to do today is quite different. We're going to talk about one specific piece. And this piece is, of course, a piece of yours from 2005, and it's called Esferica Cantandote. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Perfect.
Yeah, thank you. What does it mean exactly, Esferica Cantandote?
That's a good one. It's something like spherically I sing to you, or something like
okay,
that.
Okay, that's very poetic.
Yeah. It works better in Spanish.
it's much shorter, obviously.
Yeah.
And the reason that I'm playing this today for you is because this is actually a sort of a remake, or at least a remake in my mind, to something that you did once. I'll explain what that means. During our mutual sojourn in The Hague, we used to have these really difficult Monday night meetings where we used to have to meet every Monday at about 8 o'clock and dissect a musical subject or specifically a composer. And it was rough. It was usually rough. And yeah. We used to have to go drinking afterwards, I remember, to just kind of ease the pain.
Yeah.
But
yeah. And to the Indonesian restaurant as well.
Oh, yeah. I forget about that. It's true.
Yeah. I'm sure the students still do that.
I'm sure that in The Hague, nothing has changed. Yeah. But we actually had some meetings. I think we actually never had more than one, but we did a meeting in which composers would talk about their own stuff. So it was supposedly a meeting outside of school at somebody's house. We said, let's meet together on a different day. It doesn't have to be in front of the whole class. Let's do something else. And you were presenting to us, I think we were a very small group of about 4 to 5 people.
Yeah.
And you were presenting to us Esferica.
Yeah, that's
and
great.
Whilst presenting the piece, I'd already heard the piece before, but presenting the piece, I realized what was the technique actually used to write the piece. Not only this, the whole process that you went through of collecting material for the piece, of going through the technical aspects of writing the piece and rewriting, and you will understand, actually the listeners will understand what I mean when I say rewriting. Mm-hmm. But I thought that it was completely fascinating. I was so fascinated because A, I love the piece. I think it's a great piece. And second, it's using these compositional techniques, we'll call them for the lack of a better name, which are very unique, or I should say unique to you, because you could be connected, theoretically at least, to this school of spectralism, spectral composers. Am I wrong in saying that?
Well, I mean, there is something about that. I mean, obviously, I do use certain techniques that are derived from their practice, but I think that the result is quite different. And that probably has to do with other aspects, not only the sort of technical ones, but also the, you know, sort of way of thinking about music and aesthetics and stuff like that.
Right. Well, that would be maybe interesting to get into later if we can, if we ever come to this crossroads again. Why don't we play Esferica Cantandote now, just to kind of get a glimpse of the piece as a whole, because we really will take it apart afterwards. I hope we can. And I think that's, or at least I hope that the process that you might go through, the listeners, in the next hour will be very similar to the one that I went through when I first went through this seminar with you personally. So Esferica Cantandote is played by the Ensemble Royal.
Yes, which is students of the Royal Conservatory.
Ah, and conducted by whom?
By Hans Lenders.
Okay. So this is a live concert from 2005.
Yes, correct.
Ensemble Royal, Hans Lenders, Esferica Cantandote, Federico Ruben. Thank you. There you go. Federico Ruben, Sferica cantandote. Bravo. They seem to be enjoying themselves.
Well, I hope so. I'm not sure, to be honest.
I know that you personally went through a lot of difficulties with these piece, with this specific piece, rehearsing it and presenting it, I should say, to the ensemble. We've just actually spoken about this ourselves. Difficult process. I think it's difficult for music for people to...
It's difficult music to perform as well. It's, I mean, it was much more demanding, I remember, than the other pieces done in the same program by this ensemble. So, yeah, I mean, I do understand, in a way, the sort of difficulty of putting a piece together like this.
Right.
It's hard.
This piece relates to two things that I thought that I should talk about. One of them is more of, let's call it the theoretical compositional methods, which I've mentioned briefly before, kind of relating to spectral techniques. We'll go into that in a second. The other one is actually derived from your knowledge, your reading into Kepler, Johannes Kepler. This is interesting, the name itself as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, correct.
So could you say anything about that? Because the immediate connection between Kepler, the spheres, what's the exact connection? I'm sure it's something that you've...
Yeah, well, I mean, the normally when I write a composition, I do have some sort of extra musical, thoughts before even, or as a motivation to write a piece. So normally I sort of do quite a lot of research about a certain subject which I'm interested in, and then, you know, through that kind of extra musical material, I start developing musical material, not only in the sense that, you know, I think that it's going to necessarily translate literally into the music, but it's a sort of inspiration, a sort of motivation to write a composition.
And Kepler specifically, we're talking about here, it's called Theory, Harmony of the Spheres.
Yeah, the theory of the harmony of the world.
I see. It's inclusive.
Yeah. And I mean, I was at the time interested in this kind of period, not only Kepler, but also, well, Copernicus, Giordano Bruno, and this kind of thinkers that were sort of all-encompassing, not only scientists, but philosophers, and, you know, really Renaissance men in that respect. And I became interested in Kepler because of this theory which relates to music, actually, which is about the musical ratios, the Pythagorean ratios that you know, that determine the musical intervals and stuff like that. And he thought that those ratios applied as well to the distance between the planets in the solar system, for example.
And tried in a way to show that there is some kind of harmonic unity between, for instance, the distance between planets and, let's call them, musical tones.
Pitches. So it was a kind of, he was trying to come up with some sort of universal theory that would explain many things, which is interesting, I think.
And is this why your piece is so, I can't find a different word but maximalist, but excuse me for that term, but you do realize what I'm speaking about. It's using so many different instruments. I'm thinking only of the percussion. It takes four percussion players, sorry, and they're playing, I don't know, it's a wide array. It seems to be the orchestration for percussion is as big as the ensemble.
Yeah. The percussion part, they played a quite important role in the piece. I was trying to take literally the sort of world theory in the piece. And for example, the piece is divided in sections, and in each section, I remember the percussion instruments that are used are coming from, let's say, a different part of the world. So there were, I think, five sections in which they would play, you know, percussion instruments from a specific region of the world. Okay. So and that was just, you know, one of the many sort of, you know, that's the kind of thing that I'm saying, like an extra musical idea can bring sort of actually musical motivation sometimes.
Right. I have a feeling when I spoke to you about this earlier that your excitement re Kepler and his whole theory was actually not in any way having to do with a religious aspect, or it has nothing to do with the real scientific aspect, but actually the aesthetical aspect of it. You found this very aesthetically pleasing.
I found that this kind of theories that are maybe not as proven by now scientifically correct, they, I think, have some sort of some sort of aesthetics in it, in the sense that it's a very almost beautiful thought to sort of try to reduce something as chaotic and as sort of complex as the universe, let's say, and try to sort of to reduce it to a single theory, which was this theory. So I think there is something aesthetic about that kind of way of thinking. which is almost philosophical up to a certain point.
Obviously, so it's putting order into chaos, and this really relates to formal aspects in your piece. This, of course, I know not from hearing it, I know it from speaking with you about it. The piece itself is divided with specific ratios that you've derived from Kepler himself. Am I speaking rubbish, or is this
Yeah, true? That's correct. As far as the, let's say, the sections, when they come, that is...
When you say sections, what do you mean exactly? Different focal points in the piece?
Yeah, so. in a sort of time-related.
Right.
And basically what I did is I took the before starting the piece, I took, let's say, the whole duration of the abstract piece already.
Mm-hmm.
And then I divided that into the Kepler ratios. And then I had, let's say, sort of points within time where things would happen.
This was a decision that you made a priori to the writing of notes or anything? You said, I'll take a piece, the X amount of time, and then divide it according to these Keplerian ratios, and decide that, okay, 25% into the piece on the timeline, something important is going to happen. There's going to be a change. There's going to be, midway through, there's going to be an important moment. What does exactly look like or sound like more in the piece? Is this really the beginning of new sections? Can you actually hear this in the piece when we talk about this?
I think you can. Yeah. I mean, there are some sections that are quite clear, I think, in the piece.
Okay.
And those are, you know, sort of derived from that initial kind of partition of the whole form, let's say abstract form at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Well, we will talk about specific parts of the piece, so do, if you remember, stop us and say, actually, this is an important part.
Yeah, and for example, something that I probably should mention regarding Kepler as well is that also the idea with the piece was that, you know, the sort of almost half of the piece, I think, consists of let's say this kind of natural world or chaotic world where a lot of things happen, you know, that are hard to sort of pinpoint or reduce. And then at the middle of the piece, which is obviously one of the ratios, things start to... what I wanted to do is some sort of, let's say, the process that goes in your mind as far as, you know, coming up with a theory, scientific or... Well, initially, Kepler's theory was scientific. It was just later proving that it was not correct. But initially it was, and that is, in a way, you know, scientific theories normally reduce things up to a certain point, right?
Right.
And therefore, I mean, the first part of the piece was sort of metaphor for this kind of natural world, and then the second part of the piece is more that through this kind of observation, things start to sort of I start to reduce things of what happened in the first half. So it's a kind of observation of what happened before, but by isolating certain particular things, by reducing what happened into some sort of, you know, a theory. But in the end, I don't think that in the piece it quite resolves into something that you can sort of pinpoint. So it's a kind of commentary on not only the beauty of trying to reduce the natural world, but also the sort of failure in the end of not being able to do so.
that which in itself is a very beautiful thought, I think. Yeah. It's if I remember correctly, what you have is that the middle of the piece, this point, represents a movement from, I shall call them, complex structures to something that's a bit more artificial. So what you have at the beginning relates to, we'll talk about this in a second, all the spectral techniques. You have a bunch of materials there. And when looking at the score, and by the way, for our listeners, you should know that the score is presented online. So for those of you who want to actually go through the piece whilst we're having the piece analyzed here, you could do that. And the link is in our info page. So just click on that info button and you'll see many kinds of different types of information about Federico Ruben and the link to the score. Up until that middle part of the piece, everything seems to have very complicated rhythms
And kind of organic. There's something quite organic in the way I deal with the material. And by that, I guess I mean that it's
sort of chaotic in a way.
Yeah, that the rhythms are not regular. That right. I mean, there is much more, how to put it, aperiodicity.
Mm-hmm.
Against in the second half, it becomes more and more tangible up to a certain point.
It seems that it's easier to play, that it seems more written. I say this quote unquote written. It's just everything becomes more normal to read. The rhythms are not so difficult, but there's actually the same musical motifs. You're using the same motifs and you sort of formalize them.
Yeah.
So this is in a way...
it is basically related also to the way we think about music. I mean, score, in a way, it's up to a certain point a sort of reduction of the real performance, you know.
Right.
There is also, at the end of the piece, I was writing things in a more sort of conventional way of writing music, as far as, you know, as reducing, averaging rhythms and into something that would be... something that you would write, like people, you know, like as Mozart would have written it or something like that.
Yeah, it sounds difficult to compare right now, but I guess you're right. Let's listen to another excerpt from the piece and we'll start talking about real analysis, because Federico Ruben, this you don't know, has given me a bank of sources. What you actually started doing was taking recordings, so stimulus from recordings that you have, which I asked you and you said these were just your taste. It had nothing to do with a theory. You're not trying to make a point by actually the recordings that you chose. It's just stuff that you would actually listen to at home. Starting from that, you started reducing the recordings. When I say reducing, you actually manipulated them electronically in some way.
Correct.
And then through some FFT analysis software, so basically this is something that would allow you to get the spectrum on your screen, both in numbers and visually, you started deriving what you have there, a spectrum, back to notes. So basically you took a recording, you stripped it down through filtering, put it through an FFT analysis software, and you have a way to derive notes from that, and you've put it back through the score. This sounds very difficult when spoken about, but just listen to the next example. I think it would give you a good indication of that. So that's nothing. That's 2 seconds out of Björk, in fact.
That's correct, yeah.
So from the album Vespertine.
Yes.
This is not the original. This is obviously the original having been filtered, having been manipulated in some way.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's play that again. Let's just listen to that. It's interesting. Do you remember actually what you did there? What was the process in filtering?
Well, first of all, I used processing technique that I sort of used quite recurrently in many of the recordings I used. And that was actually, it was a sort of computer bug from a software that's released by Earcam called AudioSculpt. And it was a very old version, obviously. But it had this bug, which if you would change the sampling rate of the well, this is kind of getting nerdy, but...
We are, Federico. Let's not try. And even, I mean, people who are listening to this know.
Okay, yeah.
By now.
Well, this, basically, by changing the sampling rate, it instead of just, you know, doing what normally happens when you change the sampling rate, it would make some strange thing out of it that would create what normally would happen if you change the sampling rate is that it becomes slower or faster depending on what sampling rate you're using, but in this software it also created some kind of artifacts, and
it added on to the file, just added these artifacts.
Yeah, added some artifacts, and also it added some sort of strange loop things, like it would in terms of time it would like make it irregular, and
this was completely unplanned.
Yeah, this was unplanned. That was a bug in the software.
It's fantastic.
And so I thought that it would, you know, it would be fun to use something like that, which is, you know, related to failure. And so I used this quite a lot in treating this materials, and probably you will get a, you know, get to recognize how it sounds.
Let's listen to that Björk again, then let's listen to how it sounds in Esferica Cantandote after you've reorchestrated it, I should say. Mm-hmm. Björk. Shall we do that again? And the Esferica? I'm going to play you another example of the same thing, because this is something that you've used throughout the piece, I should say. It's basically files. And it was specifically, I think it were five or six files.
Five, let's say, sound sources.
Right.
Of mostly popular music.
Right.
And then there was another one that was not popular, but we will talk about it. But something that was, I think, very obvious is that the notes were different.
And this is due to your re-representation in the score? You wrote different notes?
Yeah.
Right. So you kind of transposed it whilst writing it in the score as well.
Yeah. But we will explain that later on.
Okay. Listen to the next example. You might recognize this or not. So this is tampered as well already. Ella Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
And it's tampered, and artifacts as part of the bugging system of complements of Earcom are there.
Yeah.
Right. Let's listen to that again.
And nice click there.
Also, the click is that part of that bugging. Here it is in Esferica. Very nice. Let's listen to that. Let's just do that again quickly. Ella Fitzgerald tampered. Okay, so this is kind of the technique that you've used throughout the piece. There is one thing before we go on a rampage of actually going through a lot of tracks that we have here and seeing exactly how those were derived, or how you've derived the music for Esferica or the notes for Esferica into the piece, which relates to Gabrielli and specifically his In Excelsis,
which is again related to Kepler.
Of course.
Yeah.
You want to say why?
I think it's obvious.
Okay. We are nerds, after all. But this Gabrielli is actually a blueprint of the whole piece. And what do I mean when I say this? The Gabrielli was actually put in or superimposed onto the piece itself. You actually took parts of the Gabrielli and transposed your score, the Esferica score, after going through the whole process of taking the track, the original pop song, for instance, filtering it, deriving any kind of FFT from that, and then the notes, and then from the notes itself you started transposing the notes in the score according to melody lines in the same In Excelsis by Gabrielli.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was that, but also I sometimes used it in the let's say in the sound file itself. I would transpose the sound file itself sometimes according to the melody.
And then you would have a transposed sound file already, which you would then feed into the FFT software.
For example, yeah. But also, I used the, you know, that technique as you described it. Sometimes I would translate it in let's say the resulting score already, but sometimes I would translate it in the sound file itself.
Let's listen to the Gabrielli just to give it an example. It's a 5-minute track, I think, even more. But we can listen to a part of it.
It's quite beautiful.
It is, isn't it? But this is not the kind of music that we do here on an hour. I have a limit. I play two. Anything that's before 1900, I can play only 2 minutes of, and then, you know, otherwise I get fired.
Okay.
So. Should let you know, people, that Federico Ruben is crying. So lines like this, the lines that the choir is in fact singing, not only the soloists, the lines would have been superimposed as a sort of transposition.
Also for example, the gestures would be in terms of, let's say, when the silences come, you know, after a phrase.
Right.
That itself as well is in Esferica. So
explain that to me.
Basically, let's say the notes, I instead of having them as notes, I would consider them as some sort of container, let's say.
Right.
Where my own music would be. But for example, the phrase structure would be the same as in the Gabrieli. So let's say, you know, there is a vocal line, let's say, and then it stops and then it continues. Then that itself in Esferica, that's, you know, that happens as well. So that silence, for example, you know, in Esferica, there would be a silence as well.
Uh-huh. So the sort of linear structure of the Gabrieli itself, it imposes the line, as it were, of...
The kind of meta gesture, if you
right,
would put
right.
it there, or something like that. Yeah.
I think that actually the example that we have after this is Ella Fitzgerald as well, but it gives a good indication because you can actually hear, specifically with that Ella, what you've done is that you've superimposed, this Gabrieli on the original track of Ella Fitzgerald, and you can actually hear the Gabrieli really mutating or transforming that track as it goes along in the first, I should say, roll or the first... new presentation of the track. Let's listen to that stuff a bit, and we're gonna have to turn this beautiful Gabrieli off and wipe those tears, Federico. Grown man you are.
Yeah, and also for those people who don't know, I guess Gabrieli was active also, you know, during the same time as Kepler was alive.
Right.
So, I mean, they're contemporaries, which also, you know, relates to the whole Kepler thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not only the sort of thematic aspect about Gabrieli's piece, but also the fact that they were contemporaries. And that...
But this is interesting because it seems that everything in this piece is very hermetically closed to create a whole, sort of holistic piece. Is this something that's only relating to your fascination with Kepler? Because this would be a really Keplerian thing to do in a piece. Is this only in Esferica Cantandote, or do your other pieces actually have this... sort of inner relations, inner connections between them, everything is sort of hermetically related?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it is a kind of characteristic of my work in general, I think. Well, basically, I mean, I was attracted by Kepler because of my own process in
right.
composing as well. I mean, I do use this kind of approach in a lot of music.
Okay, let's go back to Ella Fitzgerald. So the original first, you'll probably notice this.
Times have changed, and we've often rewound the clock since the Puritans got a shock when they landed on Plymouth Rock.
Unbelievable, ladies and gentlemen. Federico Ruben is crying again.
Any shock they should try to stem.
And this is not tampered. This is the original file, because she does sound a bit higher. Or am I wrong?
No, I think
it's just my it's age. Yeah.
In olden days, a glimpse of stockings was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven.
We can't leave that on. It's just the show will become too fun, and we can't have any of that. So this is the second one, and the second one is already tampered a bit. Try to listen to the way that the original Ella Fitzgerald track is transposed. Actually, you can really hear that it's following those stepwise movements, those stepwise motion of the Gabrieli. Let's see if we can hear that.
Times have changed, often rewound. Britain's got.
I think it's the next one.
Oh, it could be.
Landed on pluck.
This is just Irkan Buk.
So what you've done here is you've put it through... What were you trying to do? Change the sample rate?
Yeah, yeah, that's the bug I was talking about. You see there's some skipping as well.
And that skipping is the bug.
I guess so, yeah.
Okay, so this one is actually the one that I was talking about. Listen to this and realize the changes. So this is actually the second generation already. It's after the sample rate change and the Irkan bug comes this.
No, it's not again. Yeah. Oh yeah, there it is.
Sounds like auto-tune. Yeah, auto-tune.
Here I think there is also some sort of bandpass filtering.
Of course, yeah. There's something happening there as well. And the third generation would sound like this. Somewhat sparse.
This is basically, it's been spectrally gated. So basically, the magnitudes, again, talking in FFT terms, back to nerdy talk, the magnitudes below a certain threshold are just replaced by silence, basically.
Amplitudes, specific amplitudes or specific spectra.
Specific magnitudes. So basically, in terms of the spectrum, if a magnitude is below a certain threshold,
right,
it's gone
away.
Yeah, it's gone away. So you actually just get those sort of bins and those sort of frequencies that have the loudest magnitudes.
Right, and this then later you would take that, what we just heard, let's listen to that again whilst we're talking, you would take this, the following, and you would in some way incorporate it into the piece.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I mean, the band filtering had a sort of purpose. It was some sort of, how to put it, how did you call that? I forgot. I forgot my Senakis classes. But but basically, you know, the band filtering would sort of limit, you know, the frequency range of what I would have left, and that way I could sort of, you know, it's almost probabilistic in the sense that, you know, what I would get there would be almost random, but not really, because it would be the sort of the loudest magnitudes, but it has a sort of random character, but it is within a certain frequency range that I would have sort of imposed before that tendency mask.
There you go. That's, man, my days of school, it's coming back to me. I still can imagine Paul Berg very early in the morning. Yeah, things that one doesn't really like remembering in Shepherd's Bush in London. Hey, never mind. This prompts a question because we're soon going to go on to the beginning of the piece again, just to realize how that beginning was derived and which material you used to derive the notes for that. The whole piece is composed this way. There is not one note in the piece which is composed, let's say, old school, the way my grandmother would have imagined a composer works. He's struck by inspiration one day and he runs to the piano or runs to the piece of paper and composes. Is any...
No.
Good on you. So let's now listen to the next example, which will be the boredoms. This is actually what happens at the beginning of the piece.
Correct.
Of the piece is boredoms. Well, the original track. Let's listen to that first.
Okay. Yeah.
So that was the original?
Yes, that is the original.
And it, which sounds pretty kooky as well, but let's see what you've done with it. First generation. So you've obviously slowed that down there, but
well, that is again the famous bug,
right?
The Yerkam bug.
Just changing the sample rate.
Yeah, the changing the sampling rate makes it slower,
right?
Because
obviously,
the sampling rate before was higher.
Right, and then it just adds these artifacts. So everything that's not related to the slowness of the track is, in fact, just a bug. You must have been so happy when you realized that it actually does that.
Yeah, well, I'm still waiting for someone to explain me the bug, because I really wonder what happens there.
Right.
I mean, why does it do that?
We can ask our technicians.
Should call Yerkam. But unfortunately, it's not there anymore in the new versions.
I see.
So they did correct that.
So when you get this file, I should mention what you see on a screen. You have a screenshot, basically, which gives you a very nice representation on screen, on the computer screen, which basically shows you the spectra.
Well, it basically shows you like a sort of graphical representation of the spectra. A
spectrogram,
from, yes,
in fact, for those who
know.
Really are.
Which basically, you know, takes, I guess, frequency as a y-axis and time as an x-axis.
And there's also the element of the amplitude, which colors it. The spectrum, which is loudest, is in fact colored.
Yeah, correct. So this is the kind of thing that spectralists did, but they normally did it to find out, let's say, the specific timbre of mostly an isolated sound, like a trombone. A fundamental note,
right?
Or
and then
a
they
pedal
would
note, I mean,
derive many different things from
and then
that.
They would derive, let's say, the harmonic structure for a piece based on the spectra of that trombone note, let's say.
That's really classic spectralism. That's how it's.
Yeah, that's the classic spectralism. And then, basically, what this kind of process is, which is basically notating, let's say, the considering those frequencies actually as notes.
Hmm.
And that's what, well, Clarence Barlow calls synthrumentation, which I love his. You know.
Does he use that as well? Does he use this technique as well?
Yeah, Clarence does use that, yeah.
Interesting. Let's listen to
which
that.
Which is basically, you know, a kind of a misunderstanding of what the spectrum does, because, I mean, obviously, if you consider each frequency as a note, then each note will have its own harmonic structure,
obviously,
but it's a kind of one of those beautiful stupid things that composers do.
Oh, don't we love them? The funny
us
thing
included.
Of course. I should mention, actually, just in passing, this is about me, but I was so I was so excited about this first time I saw or realized how
you
compose.
Exciting thing,
it is how you compose the Sferica, that I tried this myself in one of my pieces. And I realized that for those of you sitting out there and thinking, oh God, you know, horrible, this man doesn't compose, he's actually just sitting there and deriving stuff electronically. It takes more time. It took me more time to try and do the process that we were just describing. So basically taking an audio file, screwing around with it, putting it in an FFT analysis, taking that and trying to derive notes from that. I realized midway through the piece when I tried to do this that it would take me less time to just transcribe it by ear, that this is so grueling. This is a really grueling task. One really has to get used to doing this, but it also relates just to what you said before, is that instrumentation itself allows a new whole array of spectra to come to light. And my question is, because we'll soon listen to how you've orchestrated, instrumentated Boredoms that we've just heard. What were the decisions? Were you trying to make it sound as similar to what you have?
Yeah, obviously similar, but not exactly. I mean,
it
because,
can't be.
What would the point be? So, I mean, again, it was a kind of inspiration. I think what this kind of spectrograms provide is some sort of coloring book, and then you have to color it yourself by instrument, like make, you know, by use, like deciding on the instrumentation.
Let's listen to that again, just for a second, to remind our listeners what that sounded like after you've tampered with the Boredoms track. Right? Now, I think I remember that during the beginning of the piece, this is what this is, in fact, it was transcribed as the beginning of the piece, there are these stops. Suddenly, the whole ensemble stops. That's relating to
Gabriele. Yeah, correct.
So, still decisions made after the process. Let's listen to that. So, just the start of a Sferica, if you remember.
So I think you can hear it, right?
I could hear it.
Yeah. I mean, I should mention that there was, in terms of the percussion...
yeah, exactly. The percussion isn't in the original.
That's not in the original. That is a kind of, how to put it, a different layer, almost, that I composed, actually deriving it from the onsets of the continuo part of the Gabrielli. So basically the rhythms I sort of traced according to the recording of the continuo part of the Gabrielli.
Huh? I think is my question. You had the continuo part of the Gabrielli and it has, you'll have to explain
that. So every time that there's a, let's say a note, an attack, then I would...
In the continuo part?
Yeah, then I would sort of trace where that is in seconds mostly.
Right.
And then I would get a, you know, this kind of rhythmic cells from that. And then I sort of used that for writing the percussion part.
And this was done manually. You didn't do this in any kind of
FFT. I analyzed it.
You did.
And then I could see where the onsets were.
You just looked at the FFT itself and you saw these bangs of continuo.
Yeah, and then I traced that. Let's say I wrote down in time when they happened.
And just decided the instrumentation had nothing to do with that. You just basically gave it out to the instrumentation.
I think it had to do something. I think that I don't remember exactly, but I think that the four different percussion instruments were like a different, like one would be the harpsichord, the other one would be the, you know, the viola da gamba.
Beautiful. You know, this kind of thing. The güiro as the harpsichord, the viola da gamba as a triangle.
Yeah,
obviously.
Something like that. I don't remember exactly.
But okay.
Yeah.
I'll take your word for it. The one thing that I did notice, which I would like to mention, is that it seems that there's much more going on pitch-wise in the remake, in Sferica, than there is in the original Boredoms track. I'll just play you the beginning to tell you what I mean.
Well, if you want, I can explain.
I'd just like to play it just one more time for those of you if this is completely lost on them. So listen to this again. Just that beginning, and then Sferica as it's in the concert. All that fluff. And then the bass comes in. This is already...
Okay. Yeah, let me explain that. I mean...
Yeah.
Basically, I mean, I'm not taking the notes literally because, well, first of all, the kind of Boredom's original, you know, the way he's singing, he's all over the place, right?
Right.
And then when he says this waku waku, you know,
yeah,
if you would record that and make a spectral analysis, you could actually see the gliding, let's say,
right,
of the you know what he's doing with the voice.
Yeah, with the way that he pronounces the letter W, for instance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then I would take those kind of gliding things, and I would orchestrate them. And I was treating, in this case, woodwinds.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of orchestrated that gesture.
So we'll go straight into the second example. This is the Boredoms again. So the original first.
Yes.
Lovely. And let's see, the first generation of that, what happens to that?
I think it's filtered.
Let's see. Surprise you here, Federico. So not only filtered, but...
But using the kind of tendency mask kind of idea. By filtering it, playing with the filtering itself, in a way already conveying some sort of gesture.
Right. You said this was not part of an approach or part of a systematic approach towards the composition. You just said, at a certain point, I felt, now the sound should go down.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Suddenly...
Well, these are one of those composer moments you were talking
about. That my
about.
Granny would really love, yeah.
Yeah, it's just not in the piano, but in the computer.
Right. Which is interesting, because I think that with everything that happens here, all of this very technical approach, and I should say very theoretical approach, and also very holistic approach, so it seems that you've taken the same task and done it over and over again, you're using enormous amounts of taste. Like, for instance, this last example... Of course, with the orchestration, which is completely up to you. There's no theoretization. You've used no method, as it were.
Yeah. No serious method. Just like this kind of analogies sometimes, but not a real method.
So let's listen to that last Boredoms again, and then listen to how it sounds in Esferica itself. Thank you.